Episode 61 of The Pilot. The Pilot Podcast takes off now.
My name's Chris Daniel. Fly SEATS, which is short for Single Engine Air Tankers, for a company out of Lubbock, Texas.
What is going on, AV Nation, and welcome back to The Pilot. The Pilot Podcast, episode number 61, featuring Chris Daniel. Chris and I talk about a lot of things in this episode. We talk about what it's like to be a firefighting pilot, what it's like a typical day, how many landings and takeoffs they do, what a typical load is. We just get really into it. If you've ever thought about being a firefighting pilot, this is the episode for you. We talk about the typical process that you go through. We talk about how you build your hours, how you want to get the right hours to be hired by one of these companies. And it just sounds like an amazing career. It sounds like something that you can really have a very, very successful career in. Chris and I actually know each other from a couple years ago. We met at Arrowwood Aviation. It was my flight school that I went to in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was a CFI there while I was training. He was not my CFI, but we both did know of each other there. And then fast forward a couple years to our ATP CTP class that we had to take before we took our ATP check ride. And we actually were in the same class, five people. And I happen to know one of them. It just goes to show you how small of a world the aviation world can be, and it actually is. So don't burn any bridges. But yeah, Chris and I talk about a lot of great stuff in this podcast, and I can't wait for you guys to hear his story and just why he is flying the type of equipment that he's flying and why he chose this over, say, an airline pilot or anything else in that career. Aviation, if you like this episode, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can check us out on Instagram at PilotThePilot. Email me, PilotThePilotHQ@gmail.com. And without further ado, I want to go ahead and get this episode started. Here's Chris Daniel. What is going on, Chris? Thanks for joining me on the Pilot Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. And I don't think anyone knows this, but we were in the same ATP CTP course where we just talked about how we both wasted, what, like $5,000 for 5 days of absolute nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good times, you know?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
We can get into talk about that a little bit later, though, a little bit why ATP, CTP, and all that nonsense. But first thing I want to do is tell me about yourself. Tell me about why you wanted to become a pilot. When was the first time you even thought about it?
First thing would be that, and I grew up in aviation. Mm-hmm. I'm a second generation pilot. My dad is something like a 40 to 45, I think somewhere around 43 or 44 years of flying professionally.
Oh, cool.
So I grew up in Northeast Louisiana. He was a ag pilot for a lot of years and eventually moved into the firefighting.
Was it the flying. Monroe area?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, just north of Monroe.
Oh, nice.
Little town called Bastrop.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's about 20 miles north of Monroe.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah. Yeah. So
that's where Duck Dynasty's from, right? Like that area, Monroe area?
Yeah. They're from, where are they from? They're from West Monroe.
Okay. Over,
and so I get that question all the time.
About, I bet.
You know, do you know the Duck Dynasty guys? And no, I don't.
Be like, yeah, we're best friends. I hang out with them all the time. You don't see me on the show.
Well, I've seen them around. Yeah. And of course, most of the people that are from where I'm from have grown up hunting and stuff. So we've known that name for way longer than, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
Everybody else has. So
yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Well, so your dad was a pilot. You said he was flying some 42, 43 years professionally. When did you get the bug for aviation? Was it because of your dad?
Originally, aviation was not my first career choice.
Okay.
I grew up around it. My dad was also a mechanic. So, growing up, I spent a lot of time with him in the summers, especially at the ag strip or an airport, riding in airplanes with him from time to time. And then in the winters, I'd spend some time with him, helping him work on airplanes, getting them ready to go for the next ag season. But through high school, I started working around race cars.
Oh, cool.
Going to dirt tracks and things like that. And I helped some local guys there that raced local dirt tracks. And so in high school, I decided that I wanted to pursue racing as a career.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's the reason I ended up in North Carolina, was pursuing the NASCAR stuff. So I moved out to North Carolina, lived in Huntersville initially, and went to school up in Mooresville at NASCAR Tech.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
I graduated in 2004 from high school. In October of that same year, I moved out to Huntersville.
Yeah.
And pursued that for, I guess, from 2004. I graduated from 2000, graduated from NASCAR Tech, and then, you know, continued to pursue the racing stuff until 2009. It's probably about halfway through 2009. You know, my dad, I wasn't doing real well in the racing stuff. I wasn't.
You weren't making the cut.
Going through the crash of 2008 and, yeah, you know, I just really, you know, wasn't doing very well with it and, struggling to try to get on a team and find a job and all that stuff. And I just wasn't very happy. So my dad, I think, you know, knew I was struggling. Knew I was having a hard time with some stuff, and the company he worked for at the time needed some help loading airplanes on ground crews and things like that. So my dad called me probably about halfway through 2009 and asked me if I wanted to come work with him. And at first I said no. I turned him down. I said no, I'm just going to stay here and continue on.
Dad, I want to be a NASCAR driver. It's like, yeah, come on.
I want to do this.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't really have aspirations of being a driver, but just, you know, working on them and stuff.
Yeah,
it is what I was really going after. And but so initially I turned him down. I was like, no, you know, I just wasn't going to let it go. And went on through a few more months of just, you know, honestly not being happy and being miserable. And I finally called him back. It's probably about 3 or 4 months. And I called him back. I said, you know, is that offer still available? And he told me, he said, yeah. He made a phone call and to make sure. And sure enough, you know, the opportunity was still available. So it's probably November, December of 2009. I left North Carolina, headed back to Louisiana, spent that Christmas or whatever with my family there. And then January of 2010, actually January 1st of 2010, I started my aviation career, I guess. That's kind of where the career part started.
Is that when you started flying?
I had taken a few lessons when I was probably a teenager, but, you know, didn't pursue it. So my pursuit of aviation as a career started, you know, in 2010, January.
Okay.
I said January 1st. And, you know, I went, the company that he worked for at the time, they did firefighting, they did ag work, they did aerial tree fertilizing, which is when I started with them, that's what I went to do is load airplanes with dry fertilizer to put out on pine trees.
Okay, dang.
So I went to the company that we worked for was based out of Texas, and a different company than what we work for now. But they were fertilizing trees in Florida. So my first run with this company was in Florida, and went down there and, you know, really hadn't really thought a whole lot about what I wanted to do, you know, as far as aviation was concerned at the time. But it didn't take me long as to getting around the airplanes and getting around the pilots and everybody to make the decision to, you know, if I'm going to be involved in aviation, I might as well go ahead and start pursuing being a pilot. And so that's where that started, is, you know, with my entry into the aviation career.
So what you're saying was, is that you would load these planes with a fertilizer, and then you kind of fell in love with it. You kind of realized that, hey, this is something I want to do. And then in your off time, whenever you could find spare time, because I'm sure that was a very demanding job, you would go up and fly. Would you fly in like 172s, 152s, or would you get to fly the air tractors?
No, it was quite a few years before I got to fly an air tractor.
Yeah.
But so the way the timber season would work is you usually start towards the end of the summer, early fall, mm-hmm. and it goes through the winter, and you end the season somewhere usually around the April or May or somewhere like that. So, you know, I usually had 2 or 3 months in the summer off.
Okay.
And so the period of time in between, you know, this season, I really didn't consider myself to have a home. So
you're a nomad.
Exactly. Yeah. I just roamed around from, you know, in different little towns doing loading airplanes.
Yeah.
So when I left work, you know, in the summer, you know, sometimes they would need somebody to go out and help load fire planes or something, and I would do that. But for the most part, I almost exclusively worked with the timber airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that left me pretty much the summer to work on certificates and ratings.
Oh, cool.
So I would take whatever money I'd made, you know, through the year, and basically go find a flight school that could, and I would call around ahead of time to try to find somewhere that could get me done. I could get in and get done fairly quickly, so I could just knock it out when I had the time to do it.
When you were making those phone calls to those flight schools, would you say that they're pretty honest with you? That they were like, hey, yeah, you can do it in this time frame? Or did they, because, you know, flight schools, some of them are pretty shady. So did you find them to be pretty honorable with what they said? Or did a lot of flight schools kind of toy with you and play with you?
You know, I felt like they were fairly honest, the ones I called.
Yeah.
You know, I know what you mean. I've definitely had that experience. And I guess I must have had that, a little bit of that same inclination when I was calling around, because I made sure, and I would like say my private pilot certificate, I got it in Rayville, Louisiana, at a flight school, and I knew the people there.
Yeah,
it's no longer there. It's no longer there anymore. But I knew the guy who owned the flight school. I mean, he was an old family friend and everything. So. You know, I got in and knocked it out there. Now, in my instrument rating, I went to up to Little Rock, Arkansas, and I did quite a bit of shopping around there, mm-hmm. because I'd taken a few instrument flights. I just had a few days here and there, and I'd taken a few instrument flights at a couple of other places, and I didn't have a very good experience.
What was the bad experience?
Well, you know, it's like my instrument rating was like that was probably the most challenging rating that I did in training. And so I jumped in with, and it was the same place that I got my private, but it was a different instructor. And, I went in with this instructor, and I went up with him, and I'm talking about like on the second flight, like he was giving me approach charts, and we were in like actual IMC.
Oh, dang.
And, doing approaches over at Monroe, Louisiana, over at the airport.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's getting really aggravated with me about not being able to read the chart. And I'm, you know, and this guy didn't tell me like a day or two ahead, you know, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
Or anything. It's like, you know, he handed me this chart and it's like, okay, we're going to go shoot these approaches.
You said this was on one of your first or like your second flight?
This was like my first, maybe second, probably second flight with this guy.
Dang, talk about being thrown to the wolves. Here's an actual IMC. Here's an ILS. Shoot it.
What? I know. Excuse me? And I had followed a needle and a glide slope maybe a couple times before, and somebody just saying, follow the needle and the glide slope, you know. But, you know, I had never read an approach plate. I mean, this was like, you know, Chinese to me. And, you know, he got really aggravated with me.
Interesting teaching style.
Yeah. And, so I got, anyway, I just decided with that, you know, that was probably not the way to go for me. And, I did some more calling around, you know, once I went back to work. And when I got, you know, sure enough, off of work for the summer, I had already visited the flight school at Little Rock, Central Flying Service, and met the guys over there and the instructors, and met the instructor that I ended up working with, and had a really good experience over there. So it all worked out. And but yeah, I guess thinking about it now, you know, I was trying to think earlier if I've had any real bad experiences with instructors, and it just kind of that one just kind of came to me.
All of a sudden it clicked, like, yeah, I had a guy
so
that's crazy. I mean, like, that's something that you got to work your way up an instrument. Every time everyone I've ever talked to, it's like, it's kind of like they hold your hand and then they put you into the foggles in perfectly clear conditions, but this guy's like, hey, you know what, let's go shoot that approach that we've never talked about or never taught you how to brief a chart.
It was not fun. And and even going when I went to Central up in Little Rock, I had some you know, the instrument training was a real struggle for me all the way up to probably about 20 hours into it, and then it just clicked.
What was the struggle for you?
I guess being like, I could, you know, track courses, and I could, you know, track the localizer and VORs and all that kind of stuff. But I had a hard time, I guess, figuring out where I was at when I was underneath the hood.
Okay.
Like, I guess it was just
like situational awareness, like where you are.
Yeah. Like, I could look on the map, and I could look on the, you know, GPS, and, you know, but my instructor, he was, you know, he had other students, but he worked with this particular husband and wife who were doctors, and they had their own airplane. It was a 206 with a G1000, and like, it was one of the first airplanes that had the perspective, or the synthetic vision, not the perspective, but the synthetic vision.
Okay,
and so he said, you know, why don't you come up with us and ride in the back seat? He said, I think this will help you. So he put me in the back seat, and I went up and I just watched what they were doing. And that, like I said, that was probably about 15 to 20 hours into the training, and something just clicked when I did that. And when I could watch somebody else do it. And then from then on, it was a breeze, you know. Nice. I didn't have any other problems with the training. I was ready for my check ride ahead of time.
Yeah.
And, it was just, from then on, other than radio communication, you know, my radio communication and, through my instrument.
That's natural.
It was just terrible, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and, I know. Not like from you, but for me.
My examiner that did my instrument check ride called me NORAD. No. So it was, so that's always something I've worked on, is radio communication from then on. And still not perfect at it, but I'm a lot better than what I used to be.
You know, I like what you were talking about, how your instructor had you sit and ride along, because I think there's something to that. I think that some schools like ATP and some of those type of schools and some other flight schools actually practice that a lot, where they'll send you up so you can kind of not be under the pressure of your training, and you can kind of take a step back and kind of learn from their mistakes, or you can learn from the stuff that they do well. You can kind of see, be like, oh, that's what they mean. Because when you're in the moment, when you're flying, like especially when you're training, you're so fixated on what's going on on, you can't take the, you don't have the time to necessarily like work on every single aspect that you need to work on. You know, you need to kind of just like focus on this, get better at that, and focus on this. So you kind of like gradually move up, where when you're seeing this from behind, you can be like, oh, that's what he means by where I'm like, you know, that's what he means by this. So that's what that means. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I agree with that. And I've had students, you know, being a CFI myself, I've had students that have gone up with me, you know, that have ridden in the back while I worked with other students, you know, whether in at similar stages in training, and one student's struggling and the other one might be a little bit better at this particular maneuver or whatever it might be. And I think that does help. You know, as long as the student that you're training doesn't, as long as they can understand, I'm not doing this to try to bring you down
or right, show you how bad you are and how good this guy
I'm just,
is.
You know, we've all been, all been through these learning curves.
And, yeah, for sure.
So,
and it's aviation I found, and everyone that I've talked to, and even myself, and how I've experienced it is, especially with instrument, it's like, there's so much to it that it just has to click for you. And everyone has that like aha moment at a separate time and a different time. Some people have it right before their check ride. Some people have it on their first instrument ride, instrument training session. But everyone has that final moment where it's like, oh my gosh, this all makes sense. And like you said, it helps when you see other people when they get it and how they can do it. But it's also important to preface that training lesson maybe with, hey, this guy is a little bit farther ahead than you, and that's not a problem, but just learn from him, learn and kind of follow what he does and do muscle memory and go along and see what you would do and react to what he does and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. Yeah. Now, when you were, so you were around air tractors, you're around ag pilots, you're around like kind of that whole scene. When you were doing your training, what was kind of the inspiration behind your training? And what I mean by inspiration is, what did you want to do once you became a commercial pilot? Did you just want to be a CFI? Did you want to go the regional route? Or were you looking to get into the ag or firefighting route?
No, I pretty well knew once I got into the ag world. And it's, like I said, the company that I work for and the company I work for now, you know, they had both, you know, an ag operation and they did firefighting. So I was around both of them. And I knew, you know, when I got into that environment, I knew that my goal would eventually get to fly in seats, you know, the fire airplanes. And I also, you know, just being around the ag industry most of my life and being exposed to that, I knew that industry as well. And the two are tied together pretty closely.
Right.
So, you know, either way, I mean, but the fire industry, you know, when I did get a chance to be around that, coming through, you know, loading airplanes and stuff, you know, I just enjoyed it so much. I enjoyed, you know, the ag side of it too, but the fire side of things, I just enjoyed that so much that I knew that was my goal.
Yeah. So there's when you become a pilot, people don't want to go the regional side, or the more conventional way, I should say, of regional or corporate pilot. There's kind of a set out path. You know, you need to get your commercial, you need to get your multi-engine commercial, then you need to get your ATP and all that. What's kind of the pathway to becoming an ag pilot or a seats or fire pilot? Is there like a standard protocol, or is it just like you need to network yourself and figure out the best way to get in on your own?
Oh, well, there is a standard. I mean, not everybody gets there the same way. I mean, everybody's got, you know, their own path and their own story or whatever. But the similarity is usually that most people that make it into the seat world come from the ag world.
Okay.
You know, so, and a lot of us, including myself, are still active in the ag world. It's not like we just left the ag world and went and, And I mean, once you get into the fire and the flying seats, then you're full time. You're limited to what you can do in the ag world because the seasons are pretty well the same.
Right.
But there's a very close connection there. So you're really not completely removed. The standard route is for somebody to, come up, go through. You have to have an instrument rating to fly seats. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to go through, get your commercial pilot's license and have an instrument rating. And, typically you're going to have to find some way to get some ag time.
Okay.
And and a lot of the companies that have seats are also ag companies.
Okay, nice.
So, a lot of them that maybe aren't anymore at one time were an ag company. So, in my example, I got hired with the company that I worked for, and I had maybe 1,200 hours total time.
Oh, dang. Is that normal for someone to have that much time?
The minimums for, we operate under a contract, mm-hmm. a government contract, and the minimum to be able to get carded to do firefighting is like 1,500 hours total time.
Oh, dang.
And then you've got, a few hundred hours of mountain time, a few hundred hours of low level time. I mean, there's certain hour requirements within that you have to meet. But, I didn't have hardly any tailwheel time when I started with this guy. I had a tailwheel endorsement, and that was about it.
Was that from Arrowwood?
No, it was actually from the same place I got my private license.
Yeah.
So I moved into, got there, and they, David kind of started, the guy I worked for is named David. Uh-huh. He started me, flying in a little Husky that he had, and building tailwheel time, and eventually moved me into flying a little Piper Brave, a little ag airplane, and then progressed me up into 502 and then eventually into an 802. So, and that's kind of, if you talk to, different people that have gone through and gotten into the seats, you'll probably find similar stories. Now most of them are much older than me. I'm probably one of the youngest ones in the industry by a long shot. There's a few, we're starting to see, some younger guys come in, but the average age is probably somewhere around 60-ish, 65. Dang. So
y'all are going to need some pilots.
Yeah, we definitely, it's just like, a lot of other, avenues in aviation, there's a demand.
There is, so there's obviously demand. I'm just asking this because I really have no idea. What's the pay like in something like this? Is the pay kind of comparable to a lower time pilot, or does it get pretty high? Can you make a pretty good living off of it?
Oh, you can make a good living.
Okay.
It's pretty good.
That's good.
And coming up, I mean, you're gonna make some pretty crappy money.
That's but, like any other job, like starting, like whether it's a regional airline, well, exactly, back in the day, but aerial survey, I made like 25 grand in a year flying my butt off on a crappy 206 that I had to land on a mountain. But that's another story for another day, but you got to put your time in, you got to pay your dues.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, and by the time you get to, flying a seat, most people put in quite a few hours to get there. And, it's good money. It's not the best you can make as a pilot, but it's definitely a lot
respectable
better
and livable. Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. So let's say you just went through the ag process. You finally got, you're a seat pilot. Now you're officially flying firefighting. What is, I don't even know if that's the correct terminology, but I'm just going to go with it. What is like a standard season, a standard day, like a week? Like, what do you guys do? How do you do it? How do you get there? Kind of all the logistics around it. Go ahead and talk about that.
Okay. It's, our season is pretty much a summer season. Being a Texas based company, we oftentimes will have a early Texas fire season that mm-hmm. might be February, March, or April, or something like that. It usually lasts for a few weeks, but the biggest part of our season is out west, and we usually start somewhere mid-May to June.
Okay.
And we go through, and we're usually coming home around mid-October.
Dang.
So.
And you're gone that whole entire time, every single day? Yeah. Wow.
Yep. You're gone the whole entire time. So you leave. I mean, for me, I enjoy the seasonal part of it because I know when I'm gone, I'm gone working. And when I come home, I kind of know what, the amount of time I got home.
Yeah.
So they let us know. Usually sometimes we'll have a heads up, or a lot of times we'll have a heads up when they're going to send us out. And we know when to be ready to do that. Sometimes, especially, Texas fire season stuff, it's like they call and say, hey, we need you here tomorrow. but each airplane has a ground crew that goes with it.
Okay.
So when we go out, each airplane has a truck, a trailer that they can mix the stuff we put out in, and a driver. So they send us out. They assign us to a base. We stay on base with the driver and our equipment, and we basically sit around. It's similar, I guess, to being at a fire department for a firefighter.
We wait
for the call. Exactly. We sit around, usually 9 o'clock in the morning is when we usually have to be at the base. We do our pre-flights and, get ready for the day. We have a briefing. They let us know the weather conditions and what we can expect. And we sit there and we wait.
Dang.
And at some point, during the day or whatever, if they have a fire, dispatch will call the tanker base and say, we need so many aircraft, or they'll tell you which aircraft they know. They know where each aircraft is throughout the country. And so they'll say, we need, in my case, my tanker number is tanker 871. We need tanker 871 and tanker so-and-so for this fire. And they'll print us out a dispatch form as a lat long, the name of the fire, any information that we might need to know about before we get there. And from there, they hand us, we get in the airplane, we have flight suits. We have helmets, boots, basically kind of the whole fighter pilot get up.
Yeah, you guys are like fighter pilot, like Top Gun out there.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, and we take off and we head towards the fire. And, from there that's basically the life, the day to day, the season.
So what is more challenging, would you say? Would you say fighting fires in Texas or maybe the big raging fires out west?
Well, they're both challenging, but I'd say just because of the conditions out west, the western fires are more challenging.
Last year was a pretty bad one, wasn't it?
It was a very bad fire season. We started fighting fire in Texas last year in January.
Okay, dang.
And it was not only, it was a long fire season for us. And then we went out west and flew our tails off out there for the rest of the summer. So it was really bad.
Which fire were you assigned to out west? Because there's one in Southern California, one more northern. Or was there more in Colorado, or which ones were you fighting?
I spent the majority of my time in northern Nevada.
Okay.
So I fought quite a few fires around Reno.
Mm-hmm.
Fought a fire called the Martin Fire out of Winnemucca, which I think you've been to Winnemucca.
I have been to Winnemucca, the most random place in the world, but I've been there.
Yeah. there's a seat base there at Winnemucca.
No way.
I think when you went through there, it probably a few weeks after we had our season ended.
Oh, wow.
So
I just missed you.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was taking pictures in Rifle, and I think that you messaged me saying, like, hey, my outfit's flying there right now. So
yeah. The, well, yeah. The, the picture that you had taken and posted, that was one of our company's airplanes.
That's crazy. Yeah, you guys are going crazy. When I stayed there, when I got to the hotel, they warned us that the big fire was like, I don't know, like 5 or 10 miles away, but they're like, we're pretty sure it's not coming this way. They say it's under control. And I was like, can I get another hotel? It's like, I don't really want to be 10 miles away from a huge fire. It's like, I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, definitely. They were busy in Colorado too.
Yeah.
So we fought a fire in northern Nevada there out of Winnemucca that was 435,000 acres.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
Yeah, there was a lot of retardant put down there.
Now, for me, being someone that doesn't know how big fires are, is that like a standard size fire? Is that a remarkably large fire, or is that kind of normal?
No, that's a remarkably large fire. That was actually the largest. I believe I'm correct on this. I believe that was the largest fire in Nevada's history.
Dang, that's crazy.
So yeah, and it spread that. You know, it spread to get that big in, you know, a very short amount of time.
Did they ever figure out how it started?
Yeah, it actually got started on 4th of July night.
Oh, no.
A couple of kids out, you know, lighting fireworks and caught it on fire. And it was probably midnight, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning when the fire started. And by the time, you know, the next morning rolled around and they could start getting resources on it.
Yeah.
It had already spread a few thousand acres.
Dang, just like that.
And then with the type of fuels that are out there being grass.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff, if a wind picks up, it just takes off. So
it's dry out there too. From what I remember, it's windy and dry.
Yeah. So once a fire gets lit, and the wind starts pushing it, it'll just go and go and go.
Could you imagine being the person that started that fire? Like, hey, I mean, all of us, everyone listening to this has played with fireworks. Everyone has messed around with fireworks or fire in general. And it's just like, you don't really understand the severity of what fire can do, which I know you know because you're in the industry, but it's like, it could just be a kid out there just lighting matches. And all of a sudden the wind catches in the right moment and boom, you have a 500-acre fire or whatever, 500,000-acre fire. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's a serious deal out there because, I mean, it's not just like, you know, a lot of places where you know, it's green it's green during the summer. And, you know, even if a fire did start, it's probably not going to do much.
Right.
Out there, you know, everything is, you know, especially by the middle of the summer, everything's going without rain for a long time. Everything's dry and anything will burn. So,
anything.
You know, it becomes a huge deal, and it can become, you know, a criminal, you know, offense and felony charges and jail time and you know, it just depending on whether, you know, some people do it intentionally.
Yeah.
You know, there's arsonists out there that go around and set fires intentionally and they usually get caught.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for those people, you know, it's jail time. And for people who didn't intentionally do it, there's still some consequences, but you know, they do take into account that, hey, this was an accident.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate accident. It really is. But yeah, it's like, there still have to be some kind of consequences or reprimands.
Yeah. We fought a fire a couple years ago up just north. I don't know if you've ever been to Cedar City.
No, I haven't.
Cedar City, Utah. And there's a little area up, kind of up the mountains there to the east called Bryan Head. And there's I believe there's a bunch of ski resorts and ski slopes and stuff up there. And this guy started the fire. He was outside one day and there was still snow on the ground. This was very early in the fire season. He was out there torching his weeds on his driveway. So with one of those little propane torches.
Oh, geez. I can just say, have you seen Elon Musk's like not real flamethrowers, but they're considered flamethrowers? It's like, I can imagine this guy with a flamethrower out there, like trying to torch his weeds.
Yeah. Yes. And he started a fire. And this fire burned all season.
Oh.
So, and took out, you know, all kinds of, you know, homes, like in, you know, multi-million dollar homes up there.
And yeah, there's some nice houses in those areas.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, he never intended to for that to happen, but, you know, it did.
That's going to be a reputation he has forever, because, you know, the small communities, like, and that's where Dave lives. Dave is the one that burnt down 600,000 acres.
Not a good deal.
Not a good deal at all. That's crazy. Yeah. So one thing that interests me is what, so like, say you're over in Winnemucca, you're fighting a fire. It's the worst it's ever been. What are you doing? What kind of, how do you stay safe? Like, kind of talk about from takeoff, you load up. How many times do you take off and land in a day? And just kind of like go through the actual day of fighting that fire in Winnemucca when it was at its strongest.
I'll just use that Martin fire as an example.
Yeah.
And you know, as far as how many loads we do in a day depends on how far we are from the fire.
Yeah.
So that fire, I believe, if I remember correctly, is about 40 miles one way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're doing about a 40-minute round trip in that case. So we're doing a load about every 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
And, we're limited to 8 hours of flight time in a day. So 8.0, you know, is the longest we can go. So we go out, we do have limitations built into the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have wind limits of say like a 30 knot wind, and this is at the fire. So 30 knot wind, no more than, if it's more than a 15 knot gust spread, you know, conditions like that, we're actually supposed to, they're supposed to call it and shut it, you know, shut it down.
Oh, dang.
But the, you know, we've, it's pretty common for us to fly in 30 knot winds. And, you know, the conditions are usually hot, bumpy, you know.
Not your ideal flying conditions.
Yeah, not your ideal flying conditions, but. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of safety built into it.
That's good, because it's dangerous flying. Even with ag flying, it's dangerous, just inherently dangerous. And then when you go ahead and add huge fires with lots of smoke. Now, do you guys fly through the smoke to drop the retardant, or do you fly above the smoke? How does that work?
No, we try to stay clear of flying through the smoke.
Okay.
You know, most of the time that's plenty doable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's common for us to fly through a little bit of drift smoke or something like that, but you definitely don't want to get caught up in like the, you know, the bulk of the smoke or anything. That's just, it's not good for, well, you know, obviously visibility.
Yeah.
And
obviously.
Then, the other is you don't want to, suck any ash into the engine.
Yeah. It's not good for the turbine, know? Right?
Yeah. That's not a good thing. But outside of a few circumstances, you know, we're not gonna be in the smoke.
Yeah.
What we do is we put out primarily retardant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the red stuff that people see coming out of the airplane.
Okay.
And it's basically it's mixed with water, and we put that out along the fire line or out ahead of the fire line.
Okay, gotcha.
And it's designed to slow the fire down so that the ground crews can get in there and try to stay caught up with it.
Okay. Interesting. Cause I always thought that the retardant was dropped on the fire to put out the fire, but it's more of to kind of contain the fire, to get it in a certain area so the ground people can then go ahead and get it out.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha. Cool.
I mean, and there's times when we are putting it directly on the flame.
Yeah.
But more often than not, we're putting it in a spot where it just slows the fire down.
Okay. And is that the same with the big fire tankers that you see flying around, like the huge airplanes? Are they doing the same thing, or are they more
Yeah, we're putting out the same stuff.
All right.
A lot of times we're loading out of the same airports.
Oh, really? What is kind of, let's see, I don't want to ask this. So, like, do you guys work together? Are they part of the same company? Are they part of a different company? Do you guys work in tandem with each other? Or is it all just depends on the type of the fire that's there?
We work together. We're not the same companies. We each you know, most of the companies in this are private or contractors, mm-hmm. you know, with contracts. So like in our case, we have contracts for seats, mm-hmm. and there's several companies that have that. Then the heavies, that's what we call the bigger airplanes is heavies. And they have their companies and, you know, kind of the same type of deal. But yeah, we work together all the time. When we go to a fire, we've got, you know, seats, heavies, helicopters. We got the, what they call the VLAT, which is the DC-10 and the 747.
Yeah. Those things are huge.
Yeah. Those things are huge. Yeah. You show up on a fire and we worked with them several times last year, and you know, you just kind of have to sit out there and hold,
you know, yeah,
wait
right.
for them to get their drop in, and
then you go do your thing.
Then you go do our thing. So, yeah, we all work together. We're all out there trying to accomplish the same thing.
That's good.
Yeah.
So I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming with my wife. We were driving to Denver to go catch a flight back. All our flights got messed up in Jackson Hole, but we drove through an active fireplace and there's signs all over the place, like be careful, watch out. Like they said it was safe, but they still let everyone pass. Do you guys can you drop your retardant on people? Do you make sure no one's there? Like how does that all work?
No, we're not supposed to drop on people. I'll kind of set up how this works when we're going and actually work on the fire. The fire, so TFR, you know, once a fire gets going and they've decided that, you know, this, we need to stay on this for a little while, they'll set it up as a TFR. So they set up an airspace over the fire.
Okay.
You know, so we actually talk to what's called an air attack going in and out.
Mm-hmm.
But air attack is basically like ATC. So we get clearance, we get an altimeter setting, we get an altitude to enter, and then we go in and they give us a description of where they want us to drop.
Okay.
And so we circle overhead at an orbit altitude and they give us a, once they've decided where they want us to drop and we've identified that, you know, we recognize the target and everything. They tell us we're clear to drop. They have to make sure the line is clear, which means the people are out of the way. you know, machinery is out of the way. Yeah. So once we drop down to, you know, actually get rid of the load.
Yeah.
We have to, you know, there has to be a few steps going through to make sure that everything's out of the way.
I don't know why. I can just imagine like some guy, like some older guy out taking his dog out to go to the bathroom. And he's like looking up like, man, it's a nice day. Just a little bit of a fire. And all of a sudden the air tractor flies over him, dumps all this red fiery turning on him.
I'm telling you, it's happened.
I bet.
it's happened. And, you know, for the firefighters on the ground, you know, they actually, a lot of them consider it like a badge of honor.
To get dropped on?
To get dropped on, but we're not supposed to do that. Yeah. I guess, you know, back in the day, a long time ago, you know, they probably didn't have as many rules and, today, you know, we really is better off for everybody, you know, especially, you know, in this lawsuit world to stay away from dropping on people or things like that. So,
that would suck.
But yeah, I think at some point or another, we probably all painted something red that wasn't supposed to be red.
Oh yeah, I bet. Guaranteed.
But you know,
you do more good than harm, though. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? So let's talk about. So you fly an air tractor now, right?
Yes.
What is the most amount of takeoff and landings in a day? I remember we're talking one time, and I don't know if this is true. I might have made this up in my head, but I feel like you told me you had like some like 40 takeoff and landings in one day.
I haven't personally, but you know, I've probably done 20, you know, 25, and
I'm out here complaining when I have like four or five legs, like bad crosswinds, and you're just up there constantly up and down, up and down, up and down.
Now that's in the ag world.
Yeah.
In seats, you know, if you fly all day, like if you time out, on eight hours, you've probably done probably anywhere from 6 to 10 takeoff and landings.
Okay.
So, you know, our average, I think our average turnaround just, you know, industry wide is about 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
So, you know, probably anywhere from 6 to 10 landings in a day.
That's some tough flying, man.
Yeah.
And I bet you guys are exhausted.
Yeah. Well, it is tiring. I mean, you know, in the ag, you know, the difference is, say, like the from the ag world to the seats, you know, we don't fly, say, as many hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're most of the time you're in the mountains. You're dealing with usually, you know, nastier winds. You're dealing with a lot of radio communication.
Mm-hmm.
So just the, I think the flying along with some of the mental load, you know, takes a toll on you. So, it's, you know, it's a lot of fun, the flying itself. But you know, it can be draining.
I can only imagine how draining. Like, yeah. I mean, it's, I mean, if you, like I said, like I fly a corporate jet and when I have to do 4 or 5 landings, I'm exhausted. It's like the most, to me, the most exhausting part of the job is the constantly doing turnarounds. You're constantly thinking about stuff. You're constantly rethinking about what you're going to do. And it's just very mentally tasking. And to do that 8, 6, and I mean, I'm sure, like you said, some people have done it way more than that. It could really kind of to weigh heavy on you.
Yeah, and it's like if you get a fire that's real close, you know, I mean, you, it takes you just a pull of a trigger in a few seconds to get rid of load.
Yeah.
You know, so if you get a fire that's, say, 30 miles or closer, yeah, I mean, you're turning around pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get a fire that's, say, 20 miles or 15 miles, I mean, you're basically talking to, you know, the guys on the fire, you know, when, as soon as you take off.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're going out, you're dumping a load, you're coming back, going out. So, I mean, you might be doing 4 loads an hour.
Dang.
And, I mean, that's not the norm, but, you know, it happens.
How much is in a load?
We
normally, I mean, like weight
normally wise. We can, weight wise or gallons,
whichever one, gallons.
Okay. So, we typically, we start a little bit lower with a full fuel load.
Mm-hmm.
We typically start out about 650 gallons. And then by the end of a fuel run, which we can go about 4 hours on fuel, we're up to 750 to 800 gallons. We can carry 800 gallons.
Okay.
And that's the retardant mixed with the water weighs like 9.2 pounds per gallon.
Oh, dang. So it's heavy.
Yeah, it's heavy. Our max gross on an 802 is 16,000 pounds.
Dang, that's a small plane to weigh 16,000 pounds. Yeah, I mean, you know, like it's not small, but well, it's crazy.
Yeah, if you if you're ever out west this summer and you run up, you end up on a base where there's seats, you ought to go up. I don't know if you've ever been up next to an 802, but you ought to go up and stand next to one. One of the biggest things people say when they stand next to one that they've seen them flying around and they're like, but they stand next to one and think, man, this is a lot bigger than what it looked like. So, yeah, I mean, in comparison to what we fly with, it's pretty small.
Yeah.
But it's still a heavy airplane.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, in comparison to the 747, it's definitely small, but so is everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Now, we kind of talked to this a little bit earlier, but I mentioned how what you do is very dangerous and how, or not very dangerous, but it's calculated risks, but there are dangers that some other pilots don't have to deal with. Would you say that are there a lot of accidents associated with this kind of flying? Is that very common, or is it a pretty safe safety record and flying record?
It's pretty good safety record.
That's good.
I don't have really any good hard numbers to give you, but it's definitely improved the years. I mean, there was a time when, you know, if you talk to guys who've been in it for a long time, whether they were flying seats or heavies or what have you, they were, I mean, wrecking airplanes pretty often.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of it was, especially in the heavy world, they were using old like military airplanes and stuff that were just structurally, you know, not good. Yeah. So, and they've, they pretty well kind of weeded those out. And, you know, at, you know, the industry itself is a pretty safe industry.
That's good.
And, you know, we don't see very many accidents and, you know, definitely fatal accidents anymore.
That's good. That's good to hear. Cause I mean, I don't know, just thinking about it myself, like, I feel like that would have to be, cause you guys have to, you risk your lives to, like, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, we have to put this fire out. You got to do it at all risks, you know?
Well, yeah. And you've got to kind of, like I said, there's a lot of safety built into it. And then, you know, what's very standard across the industry is, you know, lives are more important than property. So when we're out fighting fire, you know, a lot of times, you know, they've evacuated the areas that, you know, are you know, have a population, mm-hmm. you know, they've neighborhoods or, you know, whatever needs to be evacuated, they've evacuated. And a lot of times what we're trying to do is, you know, we'll be trying to save structures and, you know, property and stuff like that, which is important to try to do. But at some point, you know, when it's really nasty conditions or something, you've got to make the call on when is this good and when is it not worth it.
Right.
And, you know, those calls are made a lot, you know, and, you know, the majority of the time, I mean, I don't really consider us to be out there just putting it all on the line and, you know, risking our lives, you know, right on the edge. You know, we're out there, we're trying to do a good job. We're trying to save what we can, but all with the idea that we're going to go home at night or we're going to go back to the base every night.
Yeah.
And, cause it's a really bad deal when something goes wrong and somebody gets hurt or killed.
Yeah.
You know, that's just not a good situation to be in for anybody that's a part of the industry.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not. Well, on a lighter note, is your goal to fly the heavies? Cause is that like a natural progression to work up in the heavies, or do most people kind of stay in the air tractor?
Well, no, most people, you know, you could, you know, kind of go wherever you wanted to go in the industry, I guess. But for me, you know, the seats, I just love the seats. You know, yeah. I love being in the seats. So, you know, the heavies are, you know, for some people, probably the best way to go and a good thing to do.
That's cool.
And I think they're cool. You know, I think especially now that they've gotten into the jets and they're using the BAE 146.
Yeah.
146 is
where was the RJ. Somewhere in Montana. They have a big base there. I can't remember.
Missoula?
Yes. Yeah, I landed in Missoula, Montana, and I saw like 10 of them and I was like, whoa, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the companies is based out of Missoula. It's called Neptune.
Yeah.
And so you were probably, that's where they're based. And there's I'm pretty sure there's a tanker base there too.
Yeah. I saw those. I'm like, that's so cool.
Yeah. So they're using those, and, you know, most of the piston round engine heavy tankers are gone. So, you know, for me, I enjoy the seats.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, you never know, I guess, but
you never know.
the heavies are, that's kind of, they've got their own little world.
Yeah. And, I bet own little community, own little world.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. I got a quick rapid fire section for you where I'm just going to ask you a bunch of random questions and you say the first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay.
You ready for it?
Yeah, sure.
All right. What's your favorite airplane you've ever flown?
Oh, I'd have to say the 802.
All right. What is your favorite airplane in general? It could be a military plane. It could be a commercial plane. It could just be a random Cessna that you've seen.
I have to say the P-51.
Yeah. What is the ugliest plane you've ever seen?
Oh, geez. You know, I've listened to your podcast a couple times, and I'm going to have to go with you on this one. The Piaggio,
the flying catfish. All right, cool.
Yeah,
I got another.
That thing's probably fast as.
Oh, it is. It is a remarkable plane. It can do some amazing things. I just don't like the design of it, and I get a lot of hate for it. But it's like it's just to each his own. I mean, I can like a plane, not like a plane. Same to you, but it's just I just think it's an ugly plane.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right. Let's see. What is your favorite airline livery?
I have to say American.
American, yeah. I love that tail. Flag. What's your least favorite airline livery?
I don't know. I'd have to say the old American, you know, the silver.
On those MD-80s, they did not age very well with that. So with that, a polished aluminum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. What is your favorite airport to fly in and out of? Monroe, North Carolina.
No. Just any airport?
Yeah, any airport.
Okay, Rifle, Colorado.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
It's a cool little airport. It can be tricky sometimes, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. What's your least favorite airport you have to fly into? Maybe like the most challenging.
Least favorite airport. I don't know. It's hard to say least favorite.
Winnemucca?
Winnemucca is not my least. Yeah. The most, there's a couple of them that are really challenging, and one's Durango, Colorado.
Yeah, been there.
For us, it is just because of density altitude.
Yeah.
It's kind of in a bowl, but Reno, Nevada is kind of a tricky one for us, but just off the top of my head, I'd have to say one of those two.
Okay, that works. What's one thing you always have to have on you while you're flying?
Always have to have on me while
I'm flying. I don't know if you guys use ForeFlight or you have to have sunglasses or you need water, Gatorade, you know?
I've always got ForeFlight.
Yeah.
This year, I've been informed that we're going to have these little tracker things. So I guess if we get removed from the airplane for some reason or another out in the wilderness, they can find us.
Oh, like a spot, like a, I think like a GPS tracker.
Yeah.
That might be important.
That might become my new favorite thing.
I don't blame you at all. What's your favorite food to eat when you're connecting at an airport?
My favorite food to eat. Oh man, I'm trying to stay away from a lot of this right now. It's hard for me to walk past the Cinnabon.
Yeah, there you go. The classic Cinnabon. I feel like that was the original like crappy airport food for me. Was the Cinnabon.
Yeah.
And whenever you smell them, you can't not go up and like buy one. Man,
it's terrible.
Yeah. It's like walking by Bojangles or Krispy Kreme when they have the red light on. It's like, well, I guess I'm buying a 12 pack of donuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Dang it.
I'm going to regret this in an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Who is kind of like your favorite aviator of all time? Maybe like history wise, or do you have a favorite one right now?
Oh man. Well, the short answer to that is my dad.
Yeah.
This is one of the best things about what I'm doing right now is I'm getting to work with my dad.
That's awesome.
I'm very fortunate in that aspect, but you know, aside from that, you know, I mean, you know, guys that everybody would know, I guess, would be like a Bob Hoover or something like that.
You can't not hate Bob Hoover. He's like, he's the man. He was the man.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, cool, man. Those are all the questions I have for you. I only want one more thing from you, and that is for you to answer this question. If you have, say someone listens to this podcast and they are very interested in flying seats or they want to become firefighting, fly heavies, all that kind of stuff, what kind of tips would you give them to start out like in their training? They're just brand new pilot. They want to become a firefighter pilot. What should they do?
The main thing, get through your training, go through all your private, instrument, commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And tailwheel time is big. You know, they need to go get their tailwheel endorsement as soon as they can and get into flying that as tailwheel airplanes as much as they can.
Does it matter what they get their endorsement in? Like, I'm sure you guys want it in something more than just like a J3 or something like that.
No, I mean, you know, just the endorsement, and then the more you can get some more higher performance tail airplanes, so like 180s, 185s.
What about Pawnees, towing gliders and stuff like that?
Well, yeah, that would be a great way to go too. Yeah. My actual first ag airplane was a Piper Brave, which is a step up from a Pawnee.
Oh, really?
So yeah, those would be good little airplanes to get into. Anytime you could get into tailwheel, or you know, get in with somebody that does ag work and work your way up into an ag seat.
Cool. That's awesome. Let's see. That is all the questions I have for you, believe it or not.
Wow.
I'm finally done. Unless you have anything else that you want to say or bring up at all, in case we missed anything that you want to talk about.
Oh, no. That sounds good to me. It's time's flown by.
I know, man. It's easy to talk about this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, hey, Chris, I appreciate you coming on. Not many people know that we actually have, we've crossed paths a lot in this career without even really knowing it. I mean, we were both at Airwood Aviation pretty much at the same time. We've met each other there. And then we were both kind of just randomly walked into an ATP CTP course in Cincinnati, Ohio, or Wilmington, Ohio. Yep. And we're like, wait, you look really familiar. So it's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's this aviation world is a small world.
Absolutely. And then we both got put in a DC-9 full motion simulator with a crazy old Eastern Airways guys. that was doing the most random things.
Yeah.
So it's cool. And it's just always, I mean, you never know who you're going to run into, who you might be able to reach out to. So always have good contacts and stay in contact with people. But I appreciate you coming on the episode. I think that this is something that isn't really talked about. I mean, I talk about there's different avenues in aviation, like corporate and regionals and majors, but I don't necessarily talk a lot about kind of the other stuff you can do, like ag pilot or seats flying, like you said. And there's so much more that you can use aviation for. So I think it's really cool to talk to you and kind of get your experience and to figure out a way for people to get into this world. Because like you said, the average age of these pilots is 60 years old. They're going to need pilots as well. Just like the airlines are going to need pilots, just like corporations are going to need pilots. You guys are going to need pilots too. So I really hope someone can listen to this and think, hey, that's something I want to do. And if someone is listening to this and they want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
Oh, they can get in contact with me either on Facebook, or they can email me. They can call me. Anything.
What's your email? If you can put it out there for them.
It's Daniel, and that Daniel Aviation. That's DANIELL.
Remember the two L's, because I forgot. Yeah.
The two L's, aviationinc@gmail.com.
Cool. Well, perfect, man. Chris, I appreciate you coming on the podcast, man. Thanks so much. I'm really looking forward to releasing it.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you having me.
No problem. I hope you have a good one and wish you the best this season.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, man. See ya. And that is a wrap of episode number 61 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Like I said earlier, if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. We are so close to 300 reviews, so please leave us a 5-star review there. Check out our Instagram page @PilotToPilot or Twitter page @PilotToPilot. Starting to build that up a little bit. You can also email us if you have any suggestions of who we should have on the show, PilotToPilotHQ@gmail.com. And check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/PilotToPilot. Aviation, I hope you guys have a great day, and as always, happy flying.